This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org. Well,
I'll call us to order. Welcome, folks. So this is another installment of what we're calling Holy Conversations, the second Sunday of every month. We engage a current event or topic and really reflect on that from a position of faith, and in particular, our Episcopal tradition. And so we have a real treat today. I'm going to let Chuck introduce our guest speaker, who is a good friend of his and a fishing buddy. And maybe we'll get a fish story or two. I don't know. But we're actually going to be talking about medical ethics today. So Chuck, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you introduce Mike.
Thank you, Mona. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. I told Dr. Addis that this is the way it works. Some people have to have nutrition before they can talk about hard things. So they're gone to breakfast and they'll just keep filling in as we begin our conversation. I like this series a lot. And I think it's an important, this in particular is an important topic. But you know, I think y'all know me well enough. First, I wanted you to meet my friend Mike. Then I had to come up with a topic for him to talk about. You know, that was the way it worked. I want to introduce Mike first personally. I mean, that's where it has to stop. Mike and I have an interfaith relationship. I am a committed bass fisherman, actually, with a boat and bait casting reels. And he is a committed lifelong fly fisherman. Generally, these people never speak. They've been known to go to war, right? but we have leapt that divide, and he's wooed me into the world of fly fishing. But I am not particularly good at it, and he is particularly good at it. And he's a patient coach and teacher. And when I miss a fish, which happens often, he will just say, "Okay, Bass Pro, let's try that again." It is much gentler and much softer. Mike and I have been friends for 20 plus years. Dad's been dead 22 years. It's a strange thing to mark it on, but Mike, the way I met Mike, he was my father's cardiologist. And they lived in Waco at the time. We did not live in Waco. And Dad had a heart event. And so I went to Waco to see him and met with the docs. And that's where Mike and I met. And so we got to know each other, unfortunately, several times over the next several years. And then, as fate has it, Dad died, and then Mom was still in Waco. And a couple of years later, we were invited to go serve at St. Paul's in Waco. And so when I got there, we started a friendship for real. And Mike and his wife, Gail, and my wife, Chris, are great friends and love his girls, watched them grow up. They're now adults and parents and doing great in their own life and his son. So it's just a really deep, strong friendship. So that's the first reason I want you to know him, just because he's quality human. The other reason, though, is because of this topic. We all face medical ethical decisions pretty much every time we head to the cupboard for some medicine, or we call our doctors about anything. And then particularly, as we think about medicine culturally, you know, and how do we offer access to medical care in the United States in particular, it gets really, really complicated. And how do we make those decisions? And as Mike was saying, as we were getting started, it's important to have a template in your head before you're faced with the decision, you know, so you have some tools with which to begin the conversation as you make whatever the decisions are. So Mike, thank you. We're really excited to have you. And you're mic'd up for everything. This is just so the folks on Zoom can hear me. You're actually going to do the most of the talking. So I'm going to kick it over.
And I can move up here?
Wherever you want to.
Okay.
Go. Yeah. If you're going there, I'm going to move down here.
Okay. Well, it's good to be back at St. David's. I've been here some to worship over the years, even before Chuck was here. It's good to see some old faces and familiar friends. It's good to be back. And Chuck, his introduction was just absolutely perfect, because what I want you to think about today as we're walking through this is I'm going to give you a toolbox. You can use the toolbox. You can pick out a hammer or a saw or a screwdriver or whatever you need. The toolbox is there for you to help think through some of the things that I would bet that most, if not all of you, will have to face at one point or another, and that's some particular form of a medical ethical decision. That might be a medical decision itself. It might be a financial / medical decision. It might be an episode of grief. It might be a medical decision that you're struggling with that you don't know what's right or wrong. And so think of this conversation as just a toolbox. And I taught medical ethics at Baylor for 20 years. I'd actually started a program there called Medical Humanities. And in that, we tried to equip pre-med, pre-healthcare students, pre-nursing students, pre-healthcare policy students with ways to think through this medical crisis in America. And we are in a medical crisis. There's no question about that. We're spending still 19.5% of our gross domestic product on healthcare, and we're getting less return on our investment than any other industrialized nation in the world. So we've got real problems. We're spending a lot. We're not getting a lot back. But people still want access. They want more. They want better. Nothing wrong with that. That's part of being human. I've already seen one mistake I make, and this is the problem when you do things in the middle of the night. The first handout is called Medical Ethics, Why Bother? And I start off with a provocative statement is life consists of moral dilemmas, and rarely it should read, are they simple? So that's a 2 a.m. Error. Inevitably, we're going to disagree, right? We're human. We have different. Yeah. So the question is, how do we resolve an impasse? We see this playing out in national media, whether you're Fox News or CNN. We get stuck in our own worldviews. And so one of the things we have to do is, how can we move beyond that? I mean, I think that's the great challenge for this next election. And medical ethics is kind of the same. We get good people, well-intentioned people from different perspectives come to profoundly different solutions about any given medical ethical dilemma. So we can either say, well, I'm just going to follow my heart and do what I think feels right. And that's what most of us do. I think, to be quite frank, we just, something feels right about the decision we make, or it doesn't feel right. And so we say, well, that must be right for us. And that might not be right for Mrs. Jones. So how do we move through this kind of impasse? The first thing I would say is that we have to be objective. We have to obtain the facts as best we know them. Now, we saw this play out in the COVID crisis. The actual objective information was evolving faster than the science. And the science was evolving fast too. So the scientists were put in a really very difficult and almost untenable position of trying to present objective data about something they really didn't know very much about, because the COVID virus was new enough that we didn't know how quickly it was going to mutate, what the transmission vector was going to be. So you get this tension between the science and the policymakers and the elected officials. And as a result, we know what mess we found ourselves in. No one person was blamed for that. I think Dr. Fauci did a magnificent job. The leaders did as best a job they could, but inevitably there were disagreements, and that was just part of our collective problem. I would say that's part of our humanity, really. So obtain objective information as best we can, realizing that objective science and objectivity in the world of medical ethics is kind of an elusive goal. And I told my students at Baylor, medical ethics is not math. It's not rocket science. There's no right or wrong, but there is answers that will fit this problem the best we're able to offer, but they're not going to be perfect. If you strive for perfection in the world of medical ethics, you're going to be disappointed. Okay. So obtain objective information. Second is to provide definitional clarity. We have to agree on the terms. And sometimes we don't even agree on the terms. How can we expect to agree on the solutions when we don't even agree on the terms we're talking about? But we have to try to define the problem, whether it's distribution, access, et cetera, et cetera. Third thing we have to do is adopt a code. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit in the next page of the handout. But most societies dating back really thousands of years have had a code that is either written or verbal about how physicians and healers, going back to the shamanistic era, are required to think and behave and how they treat people with respect and dignity. Most countries have evolved a code that started off as three-part, evolved to four-part, and I'm going to go through that in just a minute. But codes are important. They give us some boundaries, a place to put certain components of any ethical decision. And then finally, we can just provide case studies. And I'm going to go through a very, very interesting case study with you at the end. And I'll go ahead and preface that so you can kind of be aware that the trick I'm going to play on you. This is a case study I presented from a book I used in my classes at a national conference on medical ethics. 1,000 people in the room, most of them healthcare providers. And I did this case study and ask at the end of the presentation, how many of you would do what you needed to save this life? And how many of you would do this to not save this life? 50% of the people said they would behave one way, 50% the other way. And these were well-intentioned chaplains, healthcare practitioners, social workers. So very kind of seemingly straightforward case that 1,000 good people wouldn't agree on what to do. So it's fascinating. We need to talk about relativism. Relativism is a pejorative word to some people. The classic relativist in medical ethics was Joseph Fletcher in the 60s and 70s, wrote a book called Situational Ethics. And he said that all ethical decisions are situational. They have to be placed in the context of where and how the event is playing out. Well, the legalistic among us, both ultra-liberal and ultra-conservative, pushed back against that, and they said, no, moral values have permanence. They're not situational. There's something at the heart of who we are as human beings that defines who we are, and if we don't live within that context of absolute right and absolute wrong, we're going to be forever swimming around in the wilderness, in the deep waters. And I understand the criticism, but I think the term itself led us into a new frontier that all ethical decisions can be situational. We have to understand the context, the narrative, the story before we understand what decision we're going to make, realizing that no decision is going to be absolutely certain. If you want certainty in life, don't go into medical ethics, because we're not going to give it to you. So let's talk just briefly for 10 or 15 minutes about types of ethical theory. Utilitarianism was a foundational, one of the two or three foundational ways we think about it. And that goes back to John Stuart Mill's, who created what he called the maximize the good. What is good? Okay, that gets back to Plato and Aristotle. But the roots of that are really quite simple. If a given act, if you have 100 people, and if a given decision is good for 60%, but not good for 40%, we should choose the which helps the most people. What that doesn't do is protect the minority. And so, you know, I remember in junior high civics, we always talk about majority rule, minority rights. And in medical ethics, we have to be careful when we make these sweeping pronouncements about how to maximize good, because even that construct can be a slippery slope, because what seems to be good on the surface may be on the surface might be counterproductive as the event plays out. And, you know, he raises the question, is there a certain standard of goodness? Is there a certain standard of goodness that we should strive for? And we'll get into that in number two when I talk about the four major ethical principles. But essential features of utilitarianism lead to what's called consequentialism. And that kind of sounds like an abstract thought, but let me just give you some examples. I'm going to give you two examples. One is from one of my heroes, and I think Chuck would attest to that too, is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a committed Christian pastor in World War II. He was a profound pacifist, but he was faced with how do you respond to ultimate evil? His theology told him that you fight back with more good than evil, but you can't fight evil with evil, right? Well, he finally realized that that was a dead-end street for him morally, and he participated in an assassination attempt on Hitler. He was caught, and he's hanged. The consequences of his action, he chose a path that led him to the death penalty. And he knew that that could very well happen if the plot was discovered. Skipping back to the current of era, I have some very good friends. One of the brightest constitutional law professors I know said, whatever bad our last president did is negated by the fact that he appointed three conservative justices to the current Supreme Court. That's consequentialism at its worst, because what it says is that the ends justify the means. And I would submit that the ends never justify the means. The means are extremely important in how we shape our moral compass, how we live our lives. So consequentialism says that that what we have to be aware of is the consequences of any decision we make, and put our decision kind of moving forward so that we can understand the consequences in a healthy and rational way. Another feature of utilitarianism is it's supposed to be impartial. Same standard should apply to you and me, somebody out in the Trinity Center, somebody in Gatesville Prison or Huntsville Prison. And I'm going to give you an example of that in a little bit. The second big profound movement that shaped the way we think about ethics in general, and then extrapolating that to medical ethics in particular, was Immanuel Kant's notion of deontological. Deontological means out of ontology. Ontology is the kind of easy way to think about it is the essence of who we are. It's kind of our basic human condition. Now, we can get into the theology of that, whether it's from Paul or Pelagius or Augustine or whatever. Those are different discussions. But Kant says that the essence of who we are should lead us to some categorical imperatives. And he said the most profound one was what he called the categorical imperative is we never treat another person as a means to our own end. We don't use people. We have to respect their autonomy. We have to respect who they are. We make any decision about their medical future or their deaths out of our own needs, but out of their needs. And people, unfortunately, or fortunately, and we're going to get into this in a little bit, bring their own stories to the table. And our case study is going to be a good example of that. Kant's categorical imperative is he called it the golden mean. It's the New Testament. Do unto others as you would do unto yourself. It's that simple. Don't make a decision for somebody else that will be different than what you would expect for yourself when you're in the same position. Okay. John Rawls took that as a more modern ethicist in the Kantian tradition, talks about the social contract. So I think that's an important evolutionary way of thinking about Kantian ethics, because it, for people within the Christian context, the Christian faith and the Christian heritage, it puts us in the context of not just me and you, but us together. And I think that's a profoundly Christian way of thinking. How does this affect not who you are as an individual, but how does this affect the community of which you participate in? Is it true to the standards of that particular community? Now, in medicine, we know we live in a pluralistic society. Not everybody's going to be Christian. Not everybody's going to be Hindu. Not everybody's going to be Jewish. So we have to be respectful of the different traditions, but we have to encourage people to kind of live into the narrative truth of those traditions as we make ethical decisions. So virtue ethics is kind of also talks, it kind of is in the Rawls tradition, originally derived from Plato and Aristotle, is how do we build a better community? How do we build a better society? And that's a great question, because it gets us out of from a purely individualistic, self-centered problem. And this, I always tell students, how does this decision make you the person you want to become? If those two things are not congruent, then the decision is wrong. If there's a congruence between the goal you've set for yourself, the kind of person you want to become, and if that's matches with the decision you're faced with, then by and large, that's going to be a healthy, healing experience for everybody. So virtue ethics is how do we build a better society? I mean, to get it real simple, how does this decision make us better, make us a healthier America? And that's a complicated question, right? I mean, that's just what we're all discussing every day when we read the news every morning. Casuistry is more of a legal term, and but it's also a medical term. It's casuistry means case studies. If I look at down somebody's throat and I see swollen lymph nodes, pus on their tonsils, there's a pretty good chance it's strep throat, right? That's a case study. So the next time I see that, oh, I've seen that once before. That must be strep throat. That's what casuistry is. It's taking a case example and saying, this decision worked pretty good this time. Let's try it again. Okay. So casuistry gives us a case study methodology. And that's how we learn. I mean, when you teach young kids, don't put your hand on a fire. It's going to burn. It takes them one time to realize that fire's hot. And yeah, it hurts like heck. So you learn, well, I'm not going to do that again. So in casuistry, we learn both what works and what doesn't work. And that's part of the way humans learn, both in individuals and collectively in communities, whether it's church communities, political communities, and international communities. Finally, in section E, narrative ethics is a branch of ethics that evolved some 25, 30 years ago that I've been particularly drawn to. It puts ethics in the context of a story. And I think that's the way humans tend to learn. When you're young and your mommy reads you a bedtime story, you say, oh, you know, whether it's, you know, Goodnight Moon, all the great teachers, including Jesus, use storytelling as a way to embrace a bigger picture of who we are as human beings. So narrative ethics, and interestingly enough, it derived historically mostly by women and mostly by feminist theologians who thought that the story was profoundly important of how we approach some of these big problems. And narrative ethics really is a way to embrace the power of the story, which is what Chuck does every Sunday and he preaches, right? You have a story. We hear it in the gospel reading, and we say, what does that story have to say to us? So in narrative ethics, what we do when we're looking at a case study, and we'll walk through this as we do the case study together, is we have to identify who the characters in the story are. It's like a novel. You know, who's the protagonist? Who's the antagonist? Who's the supporting cast? Who's the director? So I'm going to tell you a story and read you a little story, and then we're going to walk through the steps of, okay, who are the key players here? And sometimes the key players are off stage. They're not even on stage central. They're off stage in the background, but they're key players. So these are there's a few more, but those are the four or five main strands of medical ethics in the 21st century that we all kind of deal with. Having said that, there are some guiding principles And I mentioned we used to have three, we now have four. And that's an interesting story in and of itself. But going back to the time of Hippocrates, respect for autonomy was considered the linchpin of medical ethics. That the person at the center of the story, the human being in front of my exam table or my classroom, they should be responsible for his or her own future. Now, what are the problems with that? What if they're incapacitated? Then we have what's called a medical power of attorney to make those decisions. But autonomy still is considered the fundamental linchpin of discussions. And that's what this case study is really a fantastic example of: patient autonomy gone awry. So we have to be careful when we elevate that as the gold standard and put it on a pedestal or an altar and say every decision is based on patient autonomy. That can lead us into problems. The second is beneficence. And that's kind of similar to you, John Stuart Mill's maximize the goodness. But we want to do good for people, right? We want to embrace their goodness, give them a future, make them aware that the decisions we're facing with are beneficial. Third is do no harm. Now that also can become an altar, an idol, because some things carry a risk of harm. One of Chuck and Man's dear friends is undergoing chemotherapy for stage 4 ovarian cancer. It's going to hurt her. It could kill her. More than likely, it'll save her life. But we have to be careful when we outline all these possibilities of communicating the facts, the objective facts as we know them, realizing that science is constantly changing, and try not to hurt people. And we're going to circle back to that a little bit in some of the current debates about medical ethics. And the fourth one was added onto recently, just in the last few decades, is justice, and in particular, distributive justice. How do we create a healthcare system or a healthcare paradigm that has fair and equitable distribution of goods without drifting into the discussion of socialism versus capitalism? How do we create a model that works, that everybody has a fair chance and an equal chance of accessing and paying? What's the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States right now? Medical costs. Not business failures, but medical costs. That shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen in this country. So then that gets into this whole controversy, this last category, ethics, law, and public policy. So you have all these ethical paradigms. At some point, the legal system has to determine what are the boundaries of this. And then they take those laws, which the Supreme Court sometimes overrules, sometimes supports, and then say, how do we shape public policy? So that transition from thoughts to ethical law and public policy, that's the story of where we are in American healthcare in a nutshell. We're at the point I think we need a profound reimagination of public policy. And I don't think it needs to be a government takeover of healthcare, but nor should it be a pure private enterprise built around profits. That's just my personal opinion. So let's go over this case study. Missing a book. Yep, I see. Yep. I'm going to read you some excerpts. And then I want to kind of open the floor a little bit for discussion. We have about 15 minutes left. This is a great story, and I've presented this case study in big classes of thousands of people and small seminars, and nobody agrees. So be prepared to not agree. But it's a good story, and it's called The Knight of Faith. It's written by a doctor, and the Knights of Faith was one of the words from Kierkegaard talking about the possibility of existential crises. So, but there's a group of doctors standing around a bedside of a dying teenager, 17 years old. And for the sake of discussion, I always tell people he's 1 week shy of 18, but he's legally a minor. And he's a weightlifter and bodybuilder and active athlete. He's always getting hurt. And he develops a stress ulcer and starts bleeding out. So he's in the emergency room, doctors and pushing aside ventilators, ducking under tubing to get close to the bed, morning sun through the windows, lighting the dust in the room and gracing the doctor's faces with an innocent flush. The patient was a boy, and his face was heavenly white against the sheets. Just as the intern was presenting the case, the boy gushes blood and briefly loses consciousness. And so you have all these, you remember the old wards, no private rooms then, but interns, second year residents, third year residents, attendings, everybody's gathering around, this boy's bleeding out. He's been doing this all night, says a medical student. I mean to say he's been throwing up blood all night. The GI docs looked down his belly with a scope and they saw a bleeding ulcer that they couldn't cauterize. He's been taking aspirin, but he's a Jehovah's Witness. And the only way that we can save this boy's life is to give him a transfusion and go in and take care of that bleeding ulcer. Pretty, really straightforward, easy medical solution. Are you a Jehovah's Witness? One of the residents said to the boy. Yes, sir, that's right. And you don't take blood transfusion. No, sir. The soul is contained in our bodies. Jehovah's chosen my soul to see his face when he calls. That's when I die. I mean, Jehovah will not accept into heaven the body of one who is not chosen. So that's the theological underpinning of the decision. Despite his illness, though, he was a solid boy, shining with youth. The medical student found a warm feeling when he looked on the boy, a nostalgic affection stirring the ashes of his own lost son. So it turns out this medical student, this intern now, has lost a son at age 12. And that called him in midlife to a career in medicine. That tragedy shaped his, he wanted to serve, so he got into medical school. So he's brought that side story of his loss is clearly entering into this story of the patient. But he knew that he's talking now about the medical student. He knew that he was unique in his ability for medicine. He never told the other students about his dead son, always on his mind, but he realized that he had been given a sympathy for the pain of the world. The repair of your ulcer would be a simple matter, the attending was saying. We could fix you in the snap of a fingers, but we need to give you some blood first to do it. How old are you, my boy? 17. And he begins to shiver. Have you spoken to the parents about the situation? Well, they're on the way. They may be here in an hour or two. Well, we need to do something now. We need to make a decision now. The whole family holds the same views. They were very clear on the phone. They are prepared to let Jason, their son, die. 1 week away from his legal age of autonomy. So there's more to the story than that, the medical student who had lost a son. I called the county attorney this morning, and she can give us a court order to give this kid blood, a court order, see? Then we can transfuse him. Then we can stop the bleeding, and then he goes home. So the other senior attending said, there's really no ethical way to justify giving this kid blood. We don't have to be paternalistic when patients are weighing their options rationally. The medical student heard the irritation in her voice. She kept her Ivy League accent from college and used it as a weapon here in the South. Can I have a drink of water? The kid says. Death was really nearby, hovering around his dry lips, dimming the smile he flashed right after speaking. It softened their hearts to feel those hands. The boy was so young. It wasn't that they wanted him to die, she thought. She wondered if she should be fighting for a transfusion on behalf of this child, her patient. If there are 100 doctors like him in the hospital pursuing a cure as if it was a spot in a map, swaggering onto rounds and drawing about, about their big saves the night before. Try telling him that disease is a subtle and dangerous healer. So the medical student that lost his son says, give me the okay to call the county attorney. Tell him we should give this kid blood. There's still time before his parents get here. If I make the call now, we can have an answer in the hour. He's bleeding to death. He's 17, and he's going to die right here, right now. We can still save this kid. The other senior attending says, no, we don't. Grow up. We don't save lives here anymore. We settle for a lower cholesterol or higher urine output, and that's what we do. The patient was fading as they spoke, no longer aware of the conversation. His eyes rolled back in his head every few seconds. A sense of loss was drowning the resident. I know you're wrong, he says to the young boy, because my own son was 12 when he took one of the arrows of fate and is no longer my son. The attending was provoked. The parents have not given their assent. This is all by the book. We can't give the blood to someone who's refused it. We could get sued. We could be arrested for assault. So everybody was speechless. The boy was trying to watch their mouths. In his final words, he says, help me. I can't really see. His vision is fading. Are my mom and dad coming? I'm scared. I'm really scared. Help me. That's the end of the story. So, before we talk about the story, how many of you at this point in the narrative would give the kid blood without his parents there to consent for it? Roughly half. Same percentage in Boston when I gave this. How many people would let the kid die? Smaller percentage, but I don't know. I mean, there's no right or wrong. So let's apply narrative decision-making. So the characters, who are the unspoken characters in the story? The parents, they're not there yet. The intern, the medical student or intern's dead son, who clearly shaped the moral consciousness and development of his father, who's now a middle-aged medical student. The old autonomous, I'm going to do what's best. And the fearful physicians who know we got to follow the rules, follow the law. That's a big problem in Texas right now with women's health care is physicians are going to be prosecuted for defying the law. So you've got a narrative problem. There's characters we know, the young boy himself, the intern who lost a son, the parents who are off stage, and the senior attending who doesn't want any part of breaking the rules, protecting his own ass probably. So how do we, is there a resolution for this? These are everyday happenings at the bedside in America. And it's not just Jehovah's Witness. It's women's health care issues. It's who gets the funds, who doesn't. I mean, I always tell people, we tend to think medical ethics, and you talk about these kinds of cases, are beginning of life and end of life. Not realizing that most of the big ethical decisions are in that big messy mess between beginning and end. And so I think a temp, yes, sir. Well, that's a good question. Would you mind coming up and grabbing the mic? I mean, or would I do differently? Would the case read differently if the patient kid, if there's a 93-year-old rather than a 17-year-old?
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay. Well, by law, we define minority as age of 18. These kids 1 week short of 18. Healthy athlete. First he says no blood, then he's dying and he says help me. So you got this ambiguous input as to what to do.
Yes.
promise, yeah, future looks different for a 17-year-old than it does for a 93-year-old. And, you know, and fears of malpractice or prosecution are real. Doctors are retiring early because of that fear right now. Yes. What is what? Well, the law says, and the attending, the law is clear. You can't do this. He's a minor. You cannot give him blood without the parents' permission. They have refused. So the law is pretty clear about that. Yes. Back, very back. He wanted palliative care, not therapeutic care. Yeah, help me can be interpreted a lot of different ways. He might have had a change of heart. He wanted to survive. He might have just wanted some morphine so he'd drift into unconsciousness and then die. I mean, you don't know exactly what that help me meant. Yes.
So if they hadn't been able to reach the parents, mm-hmm. they could have made that decision, right? I mean, isn't it something about...
You can proceed without informed consent in the emergency care of a minor if you can't reach the parents. But he had already expressed at the start of the story, no blood. I think he had a change of heart, but I'm not sure about that. But I think the point of the narrative is that we have to be careful in imposing our own narrative truths to the situation of somebody else that has a different story. So, you know, questions this raises at the last three questions are, which model of ethical theory kind of resonates most with you? Is it virtue ethics? We choose what makes us a healthier society? Is it narrative ethics? Is it Kantian ethics that says never treat anybody as a means to your own end? Do you have any clues as to how you would approach some of these different problems? Open up a bag of worms, I'm afraid. But the question is, what text should be normative? When I say normative, I mean, you ask some Christians, so fundamental biblical text, right? Well, not everybody's a Christian. You ask a Hindu, they may answer that very differently. As a society, we've kind of pride ourselves, rightly or wrongly, on the Judeo-Christian heritage. But we've grown to where now that normative structure may not hold quite as much weight as it did 50 years ago. We're much different, much more pluralistic society than we were. And I'm going to close with this because we've got about 5 minutes. What is the most important medical ethical decision in our country? Is it women's rights, women's health care? A lot of people would say absolutely. Is it distributive justice? Is it finances or financial issues the main concern? I would say, yeah. That affects more people probably than all the other issues put together. You know, we can develop all the great drugs in the world, but if people can't afford them, we're up the proverbial creek without the paddle. My wife has a condition, needs a drug that may cost us $56,000 a year. My insurance doesn't cover it. Medicare has decided they don't cover it. We withhold categories of treatment based on ability to pay. I don't think we should, but if we pay, then do we raise taxes to do that? You know, I mean, somebody's got to pay. these companies don't develop these drugs out of the goodness of their heart. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Hi, everybody out there in the world. In the West, we seem to approach medicine as a fixing what's wrong,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to living in ways in which you mm-hmm. don't get sick to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And triage is really sort of evaluating the severity of cases as they come in, right? And then ascribing whatever
right.
is to fit that. Is there a way for ethics to mirror that in terms of a triage approach?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the triage model emerged from the battlefield experience, you know, with MASH. You know, you allocate your resources based on who needs it the most, and you save the people that are savable, and the ones that aren't, give them enough morphine, make their dying comfortable. I think it's hard to extrapolate the battlefield experience to global pictures. I mean, one of the big controversies in public health policy is this: by focusing on global issues, we lose sight of the individual narrative. And there's a lot of critique about that in medical ethical literature. How do we respect the narrative and the autonomy of the individual patient, but still pay for it as a society? And I mean, that's the tension, is between how we're going to fund this and how it's going to be delivered. Distributive justice means not only is it affordable, but everybody has access to it. All the healthcare in the world doesn't do any good if you live 200 miles from the nearest hospital. 30% of our hospitals are closing right now. So we're drowning right now in lack of an infrastructure to deliver healthcare in a global way, in a compassionate way. Yes, ma'am.
It's my understanding that the healthcare dollars are spent proportionally greater on elder care mm-hmm. than they are on our younger population, and that there's such a disparity there that mm-hmm. the children aren't getting, especially yeah. underprivileged yeah. children, aren't getting the care they need,
right.
whereas we're spending billions on keeping people alive.
The last time I looked, and these numbers might be a little different, but I think they're generally true, 25% of our federal healthcare dollars are spent on the last 30 days of life and terminal illness. If we, you know, not every 92-year-old with kidney failure needs to go on dialysis. You know, if we allocated a small fraction of that 25% to preventative health and health care for children, we'd be way better off. But, you know, here's a trick question. What's the only disease covered from diagnosis to death in America by the federal government? Kidney failure. It's not heart disease, not breast cancer, not Alzheimer's, not cancer, kidney failure. And I asked one of my nephrology friends about that. He said, we just had a better lobbyist than you did. And actually, I've heard the story of when they first passed the Medicare law making end-stage renal disease a federally funded disease, they wheeled a dialysis patient up on the podium at Congress and said, without this technology, this man's going to die. Well, they got the funding. I mean, you make the ontological argument is, if that disease gets full funding, why doesn't breast cancer or women's health or heart disease get full funding or Alzheimer's? And unfortunately, it comes down to lobbying and power and influence. Yes.
So, and I know I'm coming at it with the lens of my personal experience. My grandmother and uncle mm-hmm. had Alzheimer's, died after 10 plus years, thousands and thousands of dollars mm-hmm. Until they passed. I also had to file bankruptcy for medical bills because of my children, some health issues. So I have that Alzheimer's potential, and I have the medical bills that won't go away. Do you think there's any worst case scenario? My mother's back there having a cow. worst case scenario, if I should befall that horrible thing, have we made any progress with making the decision to end my own life without continuing to bankrupt my husband and my family?
That's a state by state problem, as you know. I mean, Colorado, where I have a house and live part-time, has a right to die law just enacted last year. New Mexico does. We know the Pacific Northwest does. Those are profoundly difficult questions. I actually co-authored a paper in the Journal of Christian Ethics with Bob Baird, who is chairman of philosophy at Baylor, an ordained Southern Baptist minister and a PhD in philosophy on can physician-assisted suicide be a Christian position? And our answer was yes. For the details, you'll have to read the article. But I think if we, you know, the word compassion, it comes from Latin, means to suffer with. It doesn't mean to distance ourselves from the suffering event, but we enter into the world of suffering of the human patient with hearts of compassion. I think sometimes the most compassionate thing to do is to help people transition to the next phase with grace and dignity. We treat our animals with more compassion than we do our parents. Yes.
Are there, in your experience, are there any cultures or countries that do medical ethics the best among the worst in terms of resolving these conflicts?
I think the Western European countries probably do a little better job than we do of making ethics easy to understand and to put it into practice. But it's hard to transition from this kind of theoretical model to the bedside. And that's kind of been part of my own journey, is how do I take these things that I've seen? I guess there's an 11 o'clock service starting. I'll tell you a really quick story I told my grandkids last night. This is a true story. I was on call for my cardiology practice about 15 years ago, 2 o'clock in the morning. They said, we got a patient with a heart attack. So get up, go in. And have you ever seen the movie, The Green Mile? Remember the man, big guy? Well, this guy made the Green Mile inmate look like a midget. He was the biggest man I'd ever seen, muscled and shackled in 4 points, wrists and ankles to the bed, 2 armed guards. He's being transported from Gatesville to Huntsville to go to death row to be executed for violent crimes. And I said, okay, tell me when your chest pain started. I was doing the kind of doctor thing, right? How do you, you know, when did it start? What does it feel like? Have you ever had heart disease? He looked at me like he wanted to rip me into shreds. And I finally told the guards, I said, you know, this isn't working. I need to get a little bit of his history. If you just unshackle him so I can examine him, then we'll decide whether he needs to go to surgery and get a stent in his blocked artery. Well, we can't unshackle him. He's violent. He's no telling what he'll do. I said, I'll tell you what, you have your weapons ready, unshackling, and let me talk to him. So they did, and I just sat by him, didn't stand up in a paternalistic way, sat by his bed, held his hand, and said, tell me your story. And this guy started crying. Probably the first time he had ever been treated like a human being in his adult life. I took him to the cath lab, opened up his artery. He went to Huntsville the next morning. So, you know, what my grand, I tell that story to my grandsons last night, 16 and 18. So why'd you save him? Well, that's what I do. I'm not supposed to judge what he did or didn't do before tonight, that night. You can make an argument that, you know, maybe the most compassionate thing would be to let him have his heart attack and die. But that, I just felt like that wasn't my decision to make. And that kind of gets involved in this whole narrative ontological question. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a DA. not a Huntsville guy pulling the executioner device. I'm just a country plumber, you know what I know. But my job was to save his life, not to pass judgment on what he did or who he was or how he got there. So I think that's respect for autonomy. That's the way I've always thought I practiced. Probably fell short more than once. You have one question.
I'd just like to put in a plug for the compassionate quality of palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about end of life issues.
Yeah.
I can get through this. When my 92-year-old mother was in the hospital with aortic stenosis, the doctors wanted to operate, and she said no. She was absolutely compass mentis at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I have her medical power of attorney, but and I was there to support her, but she said no.
Mm-hmm.
They discharged her immediately. And it was as if we can't fix her, we're gonna you have to be in the hospital 3 days before you can go to nursing care. Right. She was in 2 days. They said, we're discharging her. I ran down the hall and I found the palliative care doctor we'd been by earlier. And he did what you did. He came in, he sat on the side of the bed. He took both her hands in his. He called her by name. He said, Mary, I cannot make you well, but I can make you comfortable. Is that what you want? And she smiled for the first time in 3 days and said, yes. And we got her in hospice within an hour.
Yeah. Palliative care or hospice care, neither one should mean no care. We interpret those, I mean, we're just going to let you die. That's not what, right. Yeah. I'll tell you, I wish Chuck was here, but I'm going to share a story about Chuck and I to wrap up with. When his dad was a patient of mine, he had been in and out of the hospital for 6 months with episodes of heart failure, on ventilators, getting better, gone. Last time he looked at me and I said, Mike, I'm not ever going on that damn ventilator again. Do not let them do that to me. Well, sure enough, about a month later, he shows up in the emergency room. The ER doctor doesn't know that. Intubates him again. He's on a ventilator. So Chuck comes in, his mother comes in, his Chuck's sisters come in. And after 4 or 5 days on the ventilator, I said, Chuck, we maybe can get him off the ventilator one more time, but this is going to happen again. And here's what your dad told me. So we met I don't remember what day of the week. We met on a morning in the cafeteria about 6 a.m. and talked this through with his family and prayed about it and made the decision to take him off the ventilator. We took the elevator up to the 5th floor where the CCU was, held hands, recited the Lord's Prayer in the 23rd Psalm. I reached over and disconnected the ventilator, and his father passed while we were standing there. I think that's the most compassionate thing we could have done. That was what he wanted. That was respecting his autonomy. It was consistent with his theology and our theology. And, you know, some attendings would probably say, no, you got to keep fighting. Well, the fight was over. We were just prolonging his suffering.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.